Quad Cities in 1970 when my dad got a job out at the Rock Island Arsenal. And I had been a Cub Scout in South Bend, Indiana, and had joined a scout troop there, had belonged for, you know, about a year when we moved here. So I was a first-class scout, had been to summer camp, that sort of thing, and wound up joined a church in Bettendorf. I joined the scout troop at the church in Bettendorf. And, you know, over the next few years, got involved, you know, working camp staff, Order of the Arrow, eventually became lodge chief here. Once I finished the work on my Eagle, we started an Explorer Post, the precursor to modern venturing.
Yeah.
And I got involved at the console level, what was called the Explorer Officers Association, which is now called the Venturing Officers
yeah.
Association. And I eventually became the chairman of for the console of that group. So actually, there was some overlap for 6, 7, maybe 8 months. I served as both the Lodge Chief and the Explorer Presidents Association chairman, which I may be the only person to have ever done that. And then I left to go to college and kind of had you know, fringe involvement when I was in college. And when I got back from graduate school and went to work here, I got back involved at various little special projects and things that ranged from, you know, helping, you know, with a campery, became involved in exploring again as an advisor to an Explorer Post sponsored by what is now Rivermont Collegiate in Bettendorf.
Okay.
Got back involved on the console level, mostly with exploring.
Yeah.
Chairman of the service team, training chairman for exploring, just various jobs. Like most scouters, you know, there's a closet full of hats, and you
yeah.
just pull the right one out for the job you have. So that's, you know, that's kind of my history, a series of progressively, you know, broader jobs.
Right.
And I served for a number of years as the council vice president of program, and then was asked to be the council president.
So what lodge was it when you were lodge chief?
I was inducted into the Mikisew Lodge number 170 in 1973, became vice chapter chief and chapter chief kind of all in the same year when the fellow who was the chapter chief left the program. And then I was the lodge vice chief the next year, and then I was lodge chief the year after that. It was fun. I liked it. I went to National Order of the Arrow Conference in 1975 and really got the bug for, you know, for being involved in the Order of the Arrow beyond the lodge level. 1975 was a kind of a big year for me because I was chairman of the Explorer Presidents Association, was elected lodge chief, went to the National Explorer Presidents Congress, which was a national event that exploring had. It was kind of like a big political convention where
yeah.
you elected the national president. Went to that in Washington, D.C. It truly was, you know, this. It really was a convention experience. A U.S. senator chaired the convention. And I remember, you know, we were close enough to the White House that everybody as a group walked over to the South Lawn and Gerald Ford came out and talked to us.
Really?
So that was kind of fascinating.
Wow. And that's really cool because of Ford is an Eagle Scout.
Yeah, it was an Eagle Scout.
Yeah.
And so it was really neat. I worked camp staff that summer at Camp Mineata as a trading post manager. Left that job a little early, prearranged, because I went to the World Jamboree in Norway,
yeah.
which was a neat experience. Got back from that for about a week. Went to the National Order of the Arrow Conference at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. And you know, Andy, we're sending how many people to the Order of the Arrow Conference this year?
75.
Yeah, 75. Well, the Mikisew Lodge contingent went out in a Camaro. So it gives you an idea. And none of the people that went in 75 had gone in 1973 to California. So it was a kind of a total turnover.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of fascinating. So 75 was a big year for me as a youth. It was kind of a dream
year. Well, that would be like, there's a lot, like, you basically did like 4 or 5 summers worth of things that normal scouts would do, mm-hmm. all within the whole one summer.
Yeah, it really was. And it you know, I went to the National Jamboree in 1973, and that was a great experience. And I think of, you know, everywhere I've been able to travel and see. I've been to 49 states. I still have to get Alaska. I decided once I go to Alaska and I hit 50 states, then I'm going to start over.
And try doing it again.
I'm going to try to do it again. Not necessarily. Maybe in reverse order. If I'm close to the border, maybe I'll walk into Canada 10 feet and then walk back, and that way I can make Alaska the first state on the second 50. But, you know, I went to Idaho in 1973 for the National Scout Jamboree and hit, you know, a number of states I had never been to before. And then going to Norway in 1975, you know, was it was really my first travel outside North America.
Yeah.
And since then, I've done scouting on really 5 continents. Obviously, North America, World Jamboree Leadership in Chile, South America, World Jamboree Leadership in Australia. So there we go. American Contingent Staff of the World Jamboree in Thailand.
Yeah.
There's Asia, and Contingent Leadership to World Jamboree in Holland. So 5 continents of scouting, and I don't think there's much scouting in the Antarctica, but
right.
Maybe I'll do scouting in Africa at some point.
Yeah, that's the only one left. Like, you have to.
Yeah, I got to go to Africa. Antarctica, I may have to set my life goal at 6 continents, not 7, because I don't know that I want to go to Antarctica.
Well, you know, when you talk about, we have 75 people going to NOAC this year. Mm-hmm. And in 2002, when I went to my first one, we took 2 cars. I was in Don Johnson's Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I bet we had 10 people maybe total, if that.
Yeah. Yeah, the National Order of the Arrow Conference is a wonderful, wonderful national event. Frankly, I think it's probably the best national event that we do, because it brings members of the Order of the Arrow from all over the United States together. You know, when I first started attending the national conference, it was less than 3,000 participants. We made and it's held on the campus of a major university, generally every 2 years,
mm-hmm.
Depending on what other national events they have to be worked around. And we made a major push in 1990 at the 75th anniversary conference to up the attendance, and basically doubled it from, you know, 3,000 to 6,000-ish, that sort of thing. And so the theory was, well, here at the 100th anniversary, let's make a big push. And you know, we're looking at more than doubling it again to in the neighborhood of 15,000.
Yeah.
My function at that level is I'm the operations manager of the trading post.
Yeah.
And, souvenir shop, although it's big business. I can't tell you how much, but it's very big business. And you know, I look at it and I say, we've got to have all the infrastructure, all the plans in place in order to support twice as many participants. And it's scary. Mm-hmm. It really is scary, because if you think of any business, every business would like to double their customers. But the thought of doubling your customers basically overnight,
right,
it would cause anybody to lie awake at night.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, I think that's the major challenge in this national conference. I think it's going to be a wonderful time. But I don't know that we can have an event that continues to have 15,000 participants, because it's held on the campus of a major university, obviously, with that many people. And just having a facility that can house and feed that many people is a very, very tall order. So,
well, especially when all of your logistics for previous events is based on half the numbers.
Yeah, yeah, it's the, you know, it's the physical space, it's everything else. You know, it would be like taking your house, and you got five people living in your house, and now you're going to have 10.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, your refrigerator can't hold enough food, your kitchen table doesn't have enough chairs, you know, you don't have enough shower heads, you don't have enough beds. It's quite the challenge.
Well, and for those listening who wouldn't know, we put in a number of spots, and then we had people that thought that they were going or knew that they were going, and then we were, after that, we were given a quota on how many adults to youth that we could have. And because of that, we did have to put one adult on a waiting list, someone who was, you know, like, ready to go and going. Now they're on a waiting list if, if one of those other adults can't go. But there are other councils out there where there's 30 adults that aren't able to go. And, you know, it's, they're in much different situations where of the amount of adults that had signed up compared to youth. And people that, you know, might not be able to go to the conference where a month ago they might have thought that they were.
Yeah, it's, you know, we start, obviously we've been talking about, you know, the 100th anniversary conference for quite a while, and have had, you know, discussions about it at the last conference, which was 2012. And, you know, the goal was, hey, do you think we can get 10,000 people? I don't know. That's pretty ambitious. And so there was just the reaction was so overwhelming that we just weren't prepared for things. And there are a lot of adults who want to go to this conference because it's the 100th anniversary conference, where perhaps in the past they haven't gone. Just as I observed that there were a lot of Americans who wanted to work staff at the 2007 100th Anniversary World Jamboree in England, who had no prior experience staffing or even attending a World Jamboree. And I would imagine that, you know, finding out kind of how that event worked and what it really was quite an eye opener to them, because they hadn't they didn't have a thorough understanding of how a World Jamboree is different from a National Jamboree. But that was a that was a fantastic event too. It was kind of almost chilling. I got assigned to security staff. I don't know, but I was a good cop, you know. But I got assigned to security staff, and I think it was probably because the English knew that A, Americans spoke English, and B, they showed up to work when they were supposed to. So along with a lot of other folks, you mentioned our friend Ken before. He and I were part of the same foot patrol group. Got assigned to security, and so I wound up, in the arena, beginning to they're waiting for the units to participate, to come into the opening arena show. And I'd never done it exactly that way before, because at a World Jamboree I'd either been part of the American contingent staff, or I had been a unit leader. So you were coming into the arena with your unit. But as I'm standing there in the arena, and of course there's nothing but us security guys and the people on the stage, and all of a sudden you can hear, just begin to hear off in the distance, you know, the noise of the crowd, and it's like, oh, here we go. So it was really, it was very interesting to say, here we go, you know, the kids are coming, this is going to happen. And the historical significance of that was it was an early morning arena show, so that it kicked off right at 8 a.m., you know, by the blowing of the kudu horn, with the goal that to the minute, It was 100 years since Baden-Powell had blown the first kudu horn to open the first Boy Scout camp on Brown's Sea Island. And you know, to the minute, not just the day, not just the year, to the minute, 100 years since he'd opened the first Scout camp.
Wow.
So that was kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
The opening arena show of the World Jamboree in Australia was interesting, too, because they did a traditional Jamboree wide game where there's some 12 to 15 letter theme that you're supposed to spell, and letters are handed out to people who then have to find the folks with the other letters to spell whatever the theme is.
Mm-hmm.
But what the Australians did, which was an interesting twist to that, was that once you form this group of 12 or 15, whatever the number was, you then went to the opening arena show as that group. But it was a late night arena show on December 31st of 1987 because at the stroke of 1988 was Australia's what we called it bicentennial. They called it bicentenary.
Okay.
But it was the 200th anniversary of the founding of Australia. So
right.
So the kickoff of the World Jamboree, the opening arena show, right at midnight on December 31st, was the first official event of Australia's bicentenary celebration.
Wow, that was
fascinating.
That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a, you know, there are just neat things like that provide great memories and really make the program and the fellowship meaningful.
So now with the 100th anniversary of the OA coming up. A couple days, really. You know, like about a month away.
It's creeping up on us, but yeah, and of course we can't replicate just because of the timing. You know, we can't mm-hmm. replicate to the minute the first induction ceremony, which was held on at Treasure Island in summer 1915, but amazing to look at how vital the Order of the Arrow has become and how important it's become in retaining older youth, in retaining adult involvement in the service that's provided. And, you know, one of the most gratifying things for me in the Order of the Arrow is seeing what great, talented youth the program can present, and the while there is adult involvement, there is the conference is basically youth led. So next month, or in late December, between Christmas and New Year's, there's a planning meeting,
mm-hmm.
and the planning meeting takes place in Texas, and the young men who have been elected section chiefs, there are 50 some of them,
and one of them is Mitch Leonard.
One of them is a member of our lodge, which is just great.
Yeah, and he's not only one of our guys; he's on the podcast before.
Yeah. Oh, good. yeah. Mitch is going to be at that meeting, and it's kind of fantastic to you meet some great people who are movers and shakers, you know, not only in the Order of the Arrow but the rest of the scouting program and help make things happen. The top 2-3 rows of the organizational chart of the National Jamboree is populated with a lot of those mm-hmm. same sorts of people. And we'll do an awful lot of the planning and the setup, and the youth are primarily in charge. I mean, the adults are there to do adult things,
mm-hmm.
Negotiate contracts, spend money, and that sort of thing, but the overall framework and the theme is decided by youth.
So one of the things I think is kind of cool, not only is it the 100th anniversary of the OA, it's also the 20th anniversary of Konopacket Katiwa, and you were the lodge advisor when Makisu and Nanali merged in 94.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was appointed the last advisor of the Makisu Lodge about I'm going to say May or so, April or May of 1994. The original Iliwa Council, which was created in 1967 through another merger, was more or less absorbing the Prairie Council that served Galesburg, Macomb, Monmouth would be the major towns there. And I was tasked with getting the lodges merged. And, you know, everybody has an allegiance to their or the Earl Lodge, and nobody wants to see it go away. So it's beyond herding cats. It's like it's like an arranged marriage where nobody really wants to get married. And we worked together to make it happen, and today I think we've got a, although it was kind of a rough start, but today I think we've got a pretty successful organization. And if you look at the number of hours of service, the dollars we donate, participation, particularly as we mentioned the National Conference, I think we're in a happy place. And that was 1994. So this 2014 is the 20th anniversary. Year.
So what's cool is that you were a lodge advisor when it started, and your son is the lodge chief at the 20th. Years later.
Yeah. That you know, I'm certainly extremely proud of both of my sons, who have, you know, gotten a lot out of the program and are the people they are because to a great extent because of the program. But they've also contributed back.
Yeah.
And while the timing was off by a couple months, basically it was a little eerie because Daniel was elected lodge chief at age 17, was trading post manager this summer.
I didn't think about that,
And I was trading post manager in 17 when I was elected lodge chief.
Yeah.
So it certainly is a matter of pride for me that he's gotten that much out and making that contribution back.
Well, really quick, we mentioned that you're our current council president.
Yeah, we did mention that.
And so the first thing is what, I guess, is the role of the council president? Because I know a lot of our volunteers don't know that.
90% of them probably don't know that, and they would. Oh, you're the council president? We didn't know that. And I'm not, you know, I'm not the least bit offended by that. The council president is he's the kind of the chairman of the executive board.
Yeah.
You provide leadership at that particular level. You provide oversight to the budget process, to the manpower process. You're part of the key three. Most every function in scouting has what we call a key three.
Yeah.
At the council level, it's the scout executive, the council commissioner, and the council president. So the job of the president is to help kind of set the tone, provide some long-term leadership. You can't be thinking about, what's supposed to happen tomorrow, what's supposed to happen next month. You need to be thinking about what is this going to look like? What are our goals going to be for next year? What's our strategic plan for 5 years down the road? And are we positioning ourselves properly to be successful 10, 20, 30 years from now? So in that sense, it's a lot like a CEO's job in a corporation. You're trying to create the path and set the plans in place for long-term success, not tomorrow morning's to-do list.
You know, Ian and I have probably been working on 2015 since probably about August. You know, like what we want Catan to look like throughout 2015.
Mm-hmm.
What 2015 is only a couple of days away.
Yeah.
What is in store for the Elwha Council in the new year?
Well, in the short term, I think you've got to make sure that the infrastructure and the plans are in place to achieve those short-term goals.
Right.
Which for any nonprofit, and I'm probably the only person to ever serve as council president here who went to college and majored in nonprofit agency management. The goal is to grow your membership,
mm-hmm.
And to be financially solvent, and to improve your infrastructure. And that occurs in a number of different ways. I think most everybody knows, you know, what being financially solvent means. But you've got to be a good steward of money. just as an individual or a family, you can't spend 10% more than you make every year,
right,
because that doesn't end up happy, as some folks are painfully aware. But as an organization, you can't do that either. You know, we look for a variety of funding sources, whether it's our partnership with United Ways, mm-hmm, gifts from Scouting Families through the Friends of Scouting program, gifts from benefactors to our endowment that provides income. And then, of course, our various activities are designed to be, at a minimum, revenue neutral, so that, mm-hmm, our summer camp operation is self-supporting, our National Jamboree contingent is self-supporting, those sort of things, so that they're not, we're not draining the resources. So you know, you want to be, you want to make sure you're financially solvent. If you believe that the program is important and that youth can benefit from it, then it follows you've got to believe that you want more youth in the program.
Right.
And so we need to figure out, you know, how to reverse, you know, some of the recent trends. We've done better here than the program has nationally, but we've faced an uphill battle in, mm-hmm, in membership, and that's a long discussion for another time. When it comes to resources, it's basically physical plant resources. There's the office, and we are in a very happy place with this office. We've been excellent stewards of our assets in creating this workspace.
Yeah.
Just a fantastic thing. And then, of course, you know, we have one camp property. We're not trying to support multiple camp properties. We have one camp property. And we've got a great team of volunteers that takes care of the behind the scenes stuff, I'll use just one term and say, you know, the septic tank aspect of owning any piece of property. You know, it's a bunch of money you buried underground, you hope nobody notices it, but you gotta have it, and so it's those basic sort of things that have to happen for any property to function,
right?
And then to have the physical plant that our ever-changing and improving program needs call for. Right now, we're in the process of building some additional bathhouse facilities.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, mm-hmm, you know, when we built all that stuff now, 25 years ago, Scouting was still basically serving two customers, adult males, mm-hmm, youth males.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so our infrastructure is not designed for adult females, youth females, those sorts of things, and so that's what we're creating now, is to do that. We're also looking at some other ambitious efforts to improve the program offerings of our property. We realize that you know, scout troops, cub packs, are looking for assistance in planning good programs, and we want to have the physical facility that helps make that possible for them. We're very fortunate in that we got a pretty nice piece of property that the Boy Scouts have owned since just after the Second World War, and it's also very close.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of consuls throughout this country where their camps are located some distance from their population center. In some cases, you know, hours of driving.
Yeah.
And you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who would take more than an hour and a half to get to our property. And the bulk of our membership probably takes less than 45 minutes. And I think there's a lot of folks that don't understand how really unique and advantageous that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because so, really, La Thunder is kind of in the heart of the council.
Yeah.
It is. Yep. It is. And
it's centrally located.
That central location has come in handy two times when I was leader of the Exploring Then Venturing group to the World Jamboree. You need to have a shakedown weekend where everybody gets together, they meet each other, you do some training, and if you put up a map of the central region and try to draw crosshairs right down the middle of it, you know, the X is basically on Loud Thunder.
Yeah.
So both of those times we utilized that facility to host that particular group. So it can serve not just the needs of Scouting within our boundaries, but you know, scout groups from outside our boundaries.
Yeah.
And there's a fair amount of that that happens.
Well, I know, Matt, I came in a little late here, so please forgive me.
I'm sure you were starting a new Cub Pack.
So. I was trying. But something I did want to say before we go into our questions and everything here, and forgive me if it's already been said, but your unique perspective as council president with having the background in scouts, mm-hmm. but also having the business sense, the background in the professional world as well, mm-hmm. I think that gives you a really unique perspective in that we're not operating on simply your memories of what scouting was when you were young and what it was for your kids, and we're continuing that on. No, you understand the whole business side of things, and really what you just said for the last couple minutes there, that speaks volumes, because what happens is, and this doesn't, it doesn't resonate necessarily with some of the parents and the boys, because that's where the programs, you know, mm-hmm. that's where they're getting that program. They want to have the fun. That's what they want to have. But then you get to the district level operations, and people are thinking, well, why do we have to do all these different things and feel like we're raising money all the time? And it's because we have to operate.
Yeah.
We have to operate. There's still a business here. As much as we're a youth-serving program and organization, we put on the best events and the most exciting and fun events that we can, we still have to have something to back that.
Well, yeah, and any nonprofit faces that. I mean, think mm-hmm. of a simple example of your church.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot that goes on with having a church. It isn't just 4 hours of praying on Sunday morning.
Right.
You know, there's a building there, yeah. and the plumbing has to work, and the electricity has to work.
Yeah.
And as we can look out here right now and see, and the lot has to be plowed when it snows.
Yeah.
And all those things have to happen in order for the real mission of the organization to be achieved.
Yep.
And so, you know, to me, it takes a team of people to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And as I talk about with some of the other functions that I'm involved with, you know, if you want to win the World Series, you can't have a team of 9 all-star shortstops.
Right.
You know, you need to have people that perform various functions and have particular interests. In the real world, I'm an investment professional, and I've always made it clear that my job is asking people for money, and my hobby will not be asking people for money. So, you know, God bless those folks that come in and do all our, you know, our friends of scouting,
sure.
and our popcorn and all those sorts of things, because you got to have the funds in order to operate. And there are people who understand unit operations and can train den leaders, mm-hmm. and other people who understand cement work and can help us with stuff at camp.
Exactly.
And so you, just like a church has to have the involvement of the parishioners, where people bring their skill sets or their interest to the table, and by putting all these people together, you can make everything happen. Scouting has to have that too. And the key for, you know, not just you folks on the professional side, but for us on the volunteer side, is how can we build out this team?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the sports analogy, I think, is kind of right on.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, we got a great team, and we think we can go all the way if we can just get a right fielder that can get 50 more points on a batting average.
Right.
We can make it. And so I am a long-suffering Cub fan, by the way. I do maintain that being a Cardinal fan is one of the most gutless choices anybody can make. Because it's not hard. It's not
hard. Right.
All right. Let me get back to the discussion at hand. But, you know, the point is that if you're going to be a successful team, there's a number of roles that have to be filled.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's great to be surrounded by people who have those interests and do those things, recognizing that any one person who tries to do all those things will fail.
Right.
Right. Absolutely. No, and that's so well said. And I think that's something that, you know, Andy and I, we've discussed, you know, because definitely we see where the rubber hits the road with the boys, you know, mm-hmm. at that very first den meeting, and you get to mm-hmm. see them getting the program for the first time. And then we also see where we're looking at goals for Friends of Scouting.
Yeah.
For, you know, so we're seeing both ends of the spectrum all the way through and everything in between. And to hear you say that you truly understand that, that is amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, the guy can't stand up Sunday morning in that pulpit and say those inspiring words if people didn't raise the money to build the pulpit and to make sure that the electricity works so that you can hear him on the microphone.
That's right.
and all that infrastructure has got to be in place for the end product to be be successful, so that's my awareness, that's my desire, is to play my part in helping make sure those things happen.
Well, we're glad to have you, that's for sure.
Yeah.
We're definitely glad to have you leading this.
Well, we do have three questions that we ask all of our guests.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Raspberries. Blue.
Let's see.
Okay.
Nope. Those wouldn't work yet.
No,
we'll see.
Our first question is, what is your favorite current TV show?
Let's see. I'm not a big TV watcher, and this people probably paint a picture of me, but I do like to watch a lot of the news information shows on Sunday morning, and I'd have to say it's probably Fox News Sunday.
Gotcha.
Who's the host of that?
Chris Wallace.
Oh, okay.
The son of the son of Mike Wallace, all appearances aside, is still alive.
Yeah. See, I'm a big Chuck Todd fan, so I do Meet the Press, and that's one of my Sunday morning rituals.
Yeah,
if I'm in town or
I watch that as well, and I DVR those various shows or I download them as podcasts, so I'm catching a lot of them.
And they Chuck Todd just released a book that I've been reading, but I actually I met Chuck Todd in the oddest way when I was in college.
Men's room?
No. No, we were actually, I was in a, we were in like a sports bar in Waterloo because Jim Leach, who was a former congressman, he was in town and we went to go have lunch with the guy. And we're sitting, having lunch with Jim Leach, former congressman, and we look over and it was right before the 2008 election. So like within the week prior. And John McCain was speaking on campus the next day. We look over and I'm like, is that Chuck Todd sitting at the bar? And they were like, someone goes, no, yeah, that's Chuck Todd. And I went over and so I'm the only person in the group that would have done this. Mm-hmm. I just go over and sit down next to him and I'm like, hey, so like, and I start talking to him.
What are your thoughts?
And I'm like, I know, and he's wearing like a jacket and a t-shirt jeans, or I'm like, I know that you don't think that anybody knows who you are, and I know that you don't want people to notice you, but, you know what I mean? I'm like, but I just wanted to let you know, and so I had the potato head with me, and he took a picture with the potato head, but we went outside and did it so that it wasn't like we were drawing attention to him in there or whatever, but no, I love Monday, what do they call it, the morning zoo or whatever on Sunday morning,
you know, what you've described is a unique experience of being in Iowa and the national focus
on
the Iowa caucuses, and you know, the people who live on either coast and think of the Midwest as flyover country are always entertained by us to a certain extent, much like they're entertained by their crazy uncle, I think. But it is the opportunity to. You know, to meet people and relate to people.
Well,
it's kind of unique to Iowa.
A lot of people I know, especially more in the politically inclined world, have a story like that where it's, I know someone who was like, oh, I was in Clinton and ran into Wolf Blitzer at somewhere he was in town doing. But my favorite person who's ever been on TV was Tim Russert. Mm-hmm. And
he's a class act.
I know that I was in the same room with him at one time. I did not see him, and I did not get to meet him, but I know that I was at a big political event out in Des Moines, and someone was like, you know, this is a big deal, and I'm like, well, I just assumed, and then they go, no, you know, Tim Russert's down there. So I never saw him, but I know that I was in the same room.
Yeah, a tragic loss when he passed away. I always enjoyed watching Meet the Press when he was hosting it. It was good.
Well, when he passed, my father came out of the house, and this is a real story. He comes out of the house, and I was coming home from school or something, and he goes, hey, your buddy died.
Can you be more specific?
What is that? That's not like a thing. That's not a thing you say to someone. Yeah, now you just listed there's 150 people I know that might have just died.
You thought he was talking about the dog.
Yeah, I was hoping he was talking about the dog. Well, Matt, our second question is, if you had to start everything over again, you had to do your dream job, and it couldn't be the job that you have now, what would it be?
Boy, that's really tough. Maybe I'd like Dan McCarthy's job and be the director of the Summit Group and be in charge
that
of
would
the,
be really cool.
Our newest high adventure base and permanent home to the National Jamboree. But Dan was a great, great choice for that job. I've known him for 20 years and was really pleased when he got that job. And I know that if you want something done on schedule and done right, you get a retired 3-star admiral whose career path was in logistics. this hire makes a lot of sense. And he's done a great job with that. But he's a, you know, like so many folks that you meet in scouting who are, important folks in this program, but important folks in the outside world as well. They're truly wonderful, nice and humble people, and it's one of the reasons that I'm involved is the friends that you make, and as many people have heard me say, you're two people away from knowing everybody in this organization, and it's not 6 degrees, it's 2 degrees of separation in the BSA, and how everybody's paths intertwine and cross is really gratifying.
Our last question, Matt, is if you could meet anyone, past, present, alive, dead, fictional, and have supper with them, who would you meet and what would you eat?
Well, I guess if it was somebody from the past, I think probably the most fascinating person to me in American history would be Thomas Jefferson. And that would be very, very interesting. And it wouldn't matter to me what we ate.
Whatever was there,
I'd be good with, unless it's lamb. I'd be good with that. And I think that would be fascinating to speak to him.
And what do you think one of your first questions to be for him would be? Because there's so many different things you could ask, but what would be the one burning thing that would...
I might spend an hour describing the nature of our current
society,
political environment,
yeah,
and say, so what do you think about that?
Was this your intention?
Is this really what you meant?
I don't think they'd have any concept.
No, I don't think...
They wouldn't have anything to draw from, really. I mean...
I don't know if it was in their minds. Now, there was party division at the time, but I don't think
there always has been.
I don't think in their minds they would have ever thought the way things are right now, especially like when you look at the dynamics of like Congress, where it is so divided and everything, where I don't think that they would have ever have thought that everything would be so polarized that nobody wants to work together.
Yeah.
And because if you look... Thomas Jefferson and John Adams hated each other.
Yeah,
they hated each other. Jefferson was Adams' vice president. They didn't, and then they before they died, they patched things up. And actually, they died on the same day.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
July 4th. They died on the same day.
Yeah, like 1824 or something.
Yes. And Adams...
I didn't know this was going to be a history test. But I'm ready. Bring it on.
Jefferson passed away in the morning, and Adams died in the afternoon or evening. But back then there was no internet.
Yeah.
So Adams' last words were "Jefferson lives."
Yeah.
Even though he had passed away that morning.
Wow. Yeah.
Adams' last words were "Jefferson lives." And if anybody has not seen the John Adams miniseries from HBO that they did, that might be one of my favorite things I've ever...
Really good.
That's the only thing I've ever written a review for on Netflix. I loved every second of that. No. But no, Thomas Jefferson is a good...
He's a
very interesting part of American history because a lot of what we do now is built on the things that he did.
Well, I think we also have like an image of what we think they would have been like. And I think it would have been really interesting to actually see what they were like. Yeah. Because I don't know if they were...
They were shorter.
Yeah.
And whatever you imagine, they were shorter.
Somebody the other day, I don't know what it was on, was saying that Jefferson was the first president to have an African-American son.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, yeah, that is true. You know what I mean? When they're like... They're like, and Obama has two daughters. And they're like, so the only president that's ever had an African-American son was Jefferson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That, I think there was probably an awful lot of that that kind of everybody knew and nobody spoke about.
Yeah. Sure.
And
sure.
Now it would be...
All
you,
over
now,
the
things
yeah.
that a lot of the old presidents did, JFK, FDR, Washington,
people
you know...
People that are
like,
all over our money. No, and...
now... They look at John Edwards. Nothing different. Now they wouldn't even be allowed in the convention at the end of the day.
Right. Yeah.
So, well, we can talk about that forever. Matt, thank you very much for the stuff that that you're doing as council president, and because I really appreciate that you're at things. You know what I mean, you're at things and you're out meeting people. And,
well, it was kind of a concept when I was vice president of program. That, you know, what was the job? And I defined the job as I represent the board to the field and the field to the board. And so I tried to follow the model as set forth by R.D. Duncan. And I knew I was doing the job right. If something came up at a board meeting that was talking about something going on in the field, camp or a program or something like that, and when the comment was made, people looked at me to know the answer. Well, then I must be doing the job.
I think
it's important for me to show up and for what is important, and this is advice for you guys too, I guess, what is important to our volunteers needs to be important to me. And if you want, you guys know this because you're doing it, but if you want volunteers to work hard for you, then they need to understand that what's important to them is important to you,
right.
And you will be a great team. Sure. If they think that your values and your views on this program are not aligned with theirs, that's not a recipe for success.
Right, right.
Well, Matt, thank you very much for being our guest
today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
We'll talk with you soon.
My pleasure.